Welcome to Food Talk. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Teresa. And we're talking with the people who are growing, raising, harvesting, and producing food here in our bountiful coastal region.
And also to those who are selling, cooking, serving, and eating the freshest food available in our communities.
Join us today in a conversation about what's in season right here on the North Coast.
Today, we are talking with farmer and chef Fred Johnson of Nassau, Washington.
Welcome.
Welcome, Fred.
How's it going?
Going well. Can you tell us something about yourself? Tell us how you got here on the North Coast.
Well, that was quite a journey. When I really started cooking seriously, I lived in Atlanta, Georgia, where I'd lived for 17 years. And a whole different region of the world. Uh-huh. Definitely culinarily.
Yeah.
You know, southern low country, and there's so much old cuisines there.
Mm-hmm.
And for a number of reasons, I needed to get out of town. I had gone out to the West Coast for a season, and it just kind of blew me away. And so I started working my way across country. And first, I took a job in Arkansas at an educational facility, mm-hmm. working with sustainability issues and, you know, living patterns.
Yeah.
And they had this beautiful. They needed somebody to orchestrate their food systems. They did, uh-huh. You know, youth hostels, elder hostels, a number of events. And so they needed somebody to basically train a staff, create a menu. And they had a horticulture department, which was growing sustainably raised produce. And quite honestly, I came out of Atlanta, and I sort of didn't really have that much for organics. I just thought it was, you know, snootiness, people that had too much money and stuff. And so, I mean, not to be a jerk, but it's like I was always looking for the lowest price and the greatest volume of food.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
And I went to Arkansas and set up the kitchen, and they started bringing the produce in from the gardens. And it was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. You know, the zucchinis that are so fresh that you cut them and they're still bleeding, you know, like the
sap. Oh, it's beautiful.
And the sugars. And we're so tight still, you know, that, you know, when you harvest a vegetable, the sugars start churning to starch almost immediately, which starch has a much muddier flavor. Sugars have such clarity,
right,
and such.
Right.
And so this freshness of this food was, I'd never seen anything like it.
And so when was this?
This was back in 93.
93, okay.
Yep.
Did it change how you cooked? Did it
oh,
change
God.
Your cooking style? I mean, I can't imagine that it must have.
Well, it sort of exposed me to myself as somewhat of a hypocrite in that I was using much lesser quality. I was used to using mm-hmm. much lesser quality produce and masking its lack of flavor.
Yeah.
It's lifelessness with butters, salt, and sugar.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, principally, and techniques and culinary tricks, you know, braising. And I mean, very, you know, legitimate cooking methodologies. But
so what was your aha moment? I mean, did you have a particular, like, you just kind of went, whoa.
I started cooking. They were testing me a lot of times. They wanted to be entertained. I mean, this was in north central rural Arkansas. It was a 1,500-acre facility. It was a whole valley that David Orr, who taught at Oberlin College, uh-huh. had initiated this the whole thing. And he was just a grant writer extraordinaire. He had got something like $7 million plus to start this facility. And so we were kind of trying to walk that talk, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Then how did you move from Arkansas to the West Coast? I know you didn't start out here on the North Coast area. You ended up in the sort of Seattle area, didn't you?
It's funny with this facility. They had a great library on sustainability issues, population growth. I mean, just issues mm-hmm. of sustainability and what we were going to do with the future.
Yeah.
And it was very alarming. It was funny, the times that I had between the contracts, I had a chance to actually sit in the office and read, and it was very educational for me. So I left very much a different person after working with this incredible produce, learning how to cook simply without, you know, I don't need to do all this stuff to food to make it taste good.
If you're starting with real food to
begin
with.
If you're starting with real food, because you're really learning to accentuate what it is, not gloss over what it isn't.
Yeah.
And so you're in Arkansas. Are your customers, the people that you're feeding, are they getting it too?
The customers in Arkansas?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the elder hostels were shocked because they came in and they were like, that's what tomatoes tasted like when I was a kid. there was very much a nostalgia.
Interesting how often you get that, isn't it? When people have a really ripe tomato, that immediate, if they had that as a child,
oh, yeah.
They just go straight back to that.
And we were doing that with the greens. I mean, I was still had my purveyorships that I could pull from. But we were trying to use local as much as possible, local cheese manufacturers and stuff. I was kind of just making do with what I could put together.
Right.
But we cooked some really great food, did some great events, did a lot of youth education programs for youth hostels.
Yeah.
You know, these kids were coming in pretty much, you know, could I be so bold as to say addicted to Cokes and candy? And their palate was really undeveloped in a lot of ways. And they were quite upset sometimes. Several groups were upset when they, like for a 2-week program, they left their family's home and there was no Coke machines on the facility.
Right.
And they freaked out. It was quite tragic.
Did you find when they were leaving, was there a change?
Totally.
Okay.
Completely.
That's so cool.
It was very cool. Yeah. It was very cool. I tried to teach them to bake bread, and they weren't that interested in baking bread. But then I turned it into a pizza making course.
Oh, sure.
And so we had to make our dough from scratch. Sure. The idea being it was all from scratch.
Yeah.
Sure. That got their attention a lot more.
That's kind of exciting. Yeah.
Calzones and, you know, it's like they thought it was magic that all of a sudden they could make.
Wonderful.
They could make a calzone as opposed to just buying it. And it was a great calzone.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then you ended up on Vashon Island. Is that where you...
I had a job in Aspen. So I went to Chef in Aspen and see what Aspen was about.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of a disaster. I mean, it was just back into the mill, the food mill of, you know, that I was working at a 3-star place, but we were using the same tomatoes that they...
Right.
Purveyor was supplying to the local McDonald's.
Sure.
So it's the same product.
Yeah.
Right.
And underlying. And so it's back to the kind of the culinary fakery a bit.
Yeah.
Sure.
And then from there, because that was very disappointing, I just went to the Northwest because Seattle, Portland, well, California, you know, really, I'm forgetting her name, the restaurateur.
Alice Waters.
Yeah. Shea Panisse.
Did that great interview
the other day. I know who you were
talking
about.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. That she was down there, but I knew that I didn't want to go to California because it was way too expensive and blah, blah, blah. And so I was wanting to find either a restaurant or a farm, or ultimately both. And so I came up to the Northwest to look for farmland. It was very expensive. I started working out at sea to try to make money, to make enough money for a down payment, which I never was really able to pull off. I would make money, but...
Yeah.
It seemed to leave very quickly once I got back on the land, you know.
Funny how that works.
So your first instinct was to farm. I thought you started out as a restaurateur up there.
It was actually, I had been fishing out in the Bering Sea for 4 years, was getting pretty fed up with it because, I mean, it's...
That's hard a hard work. Life.
It's a hard life, and it's hard things that we're doing to the ocean, unfortunately. Yeah. You know, it's real frontier stuff out there and issues of sustainability. You know, it's like I wasn't walking my talk at all. And that takes a toll on you.
Yeah.
So I kept gravitating back to Vashon Island when I was in town. I had a friend that lived there. And it was an old agricultural island. You know, they grew a lot of strawberries and fruits and stuff back in the 20s, 30s, 40s. There were incredible Japanese farmers on the island.
Right.
It had that. It had largely collapsed, you know, through... The whole...
Here's the modern ag.
Yeah, the modern ag.
A lot of that stuff
and,
by the wayside.
Yeah, all that stuff. So there wasn't a whole lot of agriculture left, but there were the bones and the structure. Mm-hmm. There were farmlands.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fairly affordable, but I think I couldn't really, even when I first came there, couldn't find much in the way less than $30,000 to $40,000 an acre.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
So when you're looking at food production, unless you're just bringing a whole lot of cash into the situation...
Yeah.
Which I wasn't.
Yeah. That's just impossible.
That's just impossible. Just, yeah. And I did have kind of egotistic illusions of, I had this picturesque farm in my head, you know, this place, sort of Valhalla-ish type of a farm that was out there for me, you know? And I kept looking for it and looking for it. So I settled on the island because there was the beginnings, this was 97, 98 by this time, that there was the beginnings of local farming. So there were farmers taking it seriously. Mm-hmm. And I love cooking, you know, so I finally worked up the courage to borrow money. I'm not a big fan of borrowing money. For restaurants, debt is a killer, you know. It kills so many restaurants. They get too much in debt. They can't service the debt. And and so it just takes the cream off the milk, so to speak. So, but I borrowed some money through a very amazing benefactor. It got me going and got this restaurant going with the idea that I was going to try to connect with local farmers.
And so what was your restaurant called?
Fred's Homegrown.
Perfect.
So Cafe.
And did you connect with local farmers? Did that work?
2 degrees. I mean, there was the beginnings of local farmers there, but, you know, monetarily, their product, they were wanting, say, $10 a pound for salad greens.
Yeah.
And I couldn't pass those kind of costs off to my customer base. The customer base that had got the restaurant up and on its feet.
Yeah.
And, you know, not in the black, but at least growing.
Yeah.
I would, you know, it's the old restaurant thing.
Oh,
large
yeah.
portions,
sure.
affordable
yeah, sure.
prices.
Yeah.
Sure. You know? And we cooked from scratch. That's one thing we did do. I mean, we made everything. Short of mayonnaise and mustard and, you know, condiments.
So fast forward to Nacelle.
And now you're on the other side of that equation. I find that really interesting. And this is something I always love to talk to you about, being on the other side of the farmer chef conversation, because now you're the farmer and you want $10 for those greens.
$6.
Well,
wholesale.
Yeah.
$6
but, you know,
wholesale.
Nice.
I mean, because that's kind of where...
But now, now you're seeing it from the other side. But you also have the experience of being the chef.
That's, Well, now it's like I'm trying to become the farmer. I'm trying to become the farmer I originally couldn't find, that I had sort of theorized. I found this mythic farm and sold the restaurant, and it worked out. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
No, well, you have your farm then on Nacelle. And
I think you did find that magic farm.
It sounds
like
you did.
It is a beautiful place.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a beautiful place.
I remember the first time I turned down the driveway.
Yeah.
We'll hold that thought for just a second. We're going to take a short station break here. You are listening to Coast Community Radio, KMUN 91.9 FM, and KTCB Tillamook 89.5, and streaming live at coastradio.org. And if you're just joining us, we are talking with Fred Johnson of Nacelle, farmer and chef. And Fred is just starting to tell us about his farm.
Okay. Well, I bought my farm in 2003, and it's a 70-acre ex-dairy farm. It was an old Finnish dairy farm.
Yeah.
Had it been left to go when you found it, or was it still active?
It had gotten sold. I don't know my history terribly concisely, so don't hold me to it. But it had sold in the early 80s, and it had bankrupted.
Okay.
And so it went back to the original owners, but I think it went back in much worse shape than they had left it in.
Yeah.
Because basically through the bankruptcy, I think they pretty much gutted the place. You know, milking machinery, all the infrastructure. They
just
pretty
went,
dang near were pulling the nails out of the walls, you know, for the debt. So that's the story. So it was in it's been, you know, it needs some it needed a lot of work.
What was the land like? What did you find the
I'm still figuring that out. Quite honestly. It's a couple of different soil types. It's on the Nacelle River, so I've got some loamy pasturage. Mm-hmm. It's considered historically a valuable farmland because it's got lowlands that flood in the winter, but highlands that you can keep the cows on. And so it'd just run as a cow-calf operation in the interim. So when I bought it,
and you've gone into produce in a starting to be in a big way.
With my learning curve between the elk and soil issues, soil agronomy.
Well,
issues.
One of the things I think we all know you are doing so well is you are growing tomatoes on the North Coast. You're like a blazing pioneer that way. So how did you get into tomatoes?
A very lovely friendship I made back on Vashon with a fellow that I actually worked with him building hardwood floors. When I decided I was going to stay on the island, and he just turned out to also know how to grow tomatoes. Yeah. He had learned from a previous farmer on the island, and there was just some rules. I helped him reconstruct a greenhouse that had gone fallow for a dozen years, and he showed me how he grew tomatoes in the Northwest, which was basically greenhouses and... You know, there's a method of trimming the plants, keeping the mother vine, you know, solo, pulling all the suckers off.
Yeah.
And then training the tomatoes up strings, you know, and guying them up off the ground. Because blight is our biggest issue here.
Yeah.
You know, blossom end rot, the blight, you know. I'm suffering from it now in one of my greenhouses. because I've been planting too much. It's my fourth year in succession, and I know I'm not supposed to do it. But I didn't get that new third greenhouse together in time this year. And so I'm having some blight issues, you know, these sort of endemic things.
There's only so far you can push it.
I try to go with that. And I've also learned, you know, some of it is just opening up and learning. It's sort of terrifying, you know, to try to do something with that strong potential that you're going to fail. I as a chef and as a floor guy, you know, it's like I have to fail twice before I get anything halfway right.
Yeah.
And to forgive myself. And I wish they taught me in high school how to just fall completely on my butt and then pick myself up and try again. You know,
you do a lot of that in farming.
Oh,
well, if you're just teaching yourself, I mean, you haven't grown up to it. It's not something that you were raised to do. And so a lot of this is not instinctive or it's not just knowledge that you have.
Yeah.
You make a lot of mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes they're very embarrassing. or just you learn from them, and it's like, okay, how you do it.
You have to invest in an elk fence if you want to harvest your crops.
There you go.
It's kind of key. You can just keep feeding the elk very expensive seed, but Yeah, I know.
Okay, so beyond tomatoes, then you do kale. We were just talking about your amazing kale.
You grow the most amazing kale.
Well, thank you.
I have ever seen, I think, the stuff that you're harvesting this year, and I've just been seeing it come in these great huge bundles at the market and just being blown away. It is the most beautiful kale I've ever seen, and I know
you're too kind.
No, I'm jealous. I'm like,
tell us what you think your secret is.
me and I'm kind of excited about it.
I mean, it really comes down to agronomy issues. It's soil sciences. We've got some real common consistent issues with our soil in the Northwest, acidity, compaction, and lack of soil life, you know, organic matter enough in our soils, all these things, and then really accessing some of our available resources. You know, we've got a lot of marine waste that ends up in landfills, or we're shipping it to Central Oregon, which is somewhat silly, to put it mildly.
So you are tapping into that marine waste stream.
I'm trying to. I mean, by little forays.
Yeah.
You know, I make some hits here and there, and it seems to be very positive. And then, you know, there's little things like this glacial rock dust.
Yeah.
I don't really know what it does, but by gosh, it's like my lettuce was struggling. This last big 60-foot bed I'd laid in, struggling and just not coming in. Yeah. And I keep calling my customers to apologize for not having lettuce again that week when I thought for sure I would.
Yeah.
And so I'm experimenting.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, but boom, it just.
You try something else and it works.
And it works.
Yeah.
You know? And so those are things that I think,
Well, so we're gonna ask you to talk to the chef side of things and tell us what you like to do with tomatoes. What's a great recipe you can walk our listeners through?
You know, I'll be honest that it's a delightful process right now, is sort of re-examining so many recipes that I've had in the past. You know, say starting from simple marinaras.
Yeah.
The Mexican recipes of ranchero sauce. Uh-huh. There's a cooked tomato salsa. It's delicious. But with these sugars.
Yeah.
You have such a bounty to it, and a roundness and fullness of the flavor. So it's kind of like going back and revisiting so many of these recipes, classic recipes, but with really
with the amazing ingredients.
Produce, really. I mean, so it's a process of, it's almost like falling in love again, you know, I'd be like, oh, this is, I'm used to canned tomatoes for my ranchero sauce, and it's still a delicious sauce.
Yeah.
But now it's extra delicious.
So what do you do? How do you make it?
Ranchero sauce? Ranchero sauce, you make, well, traditionally you make it with in an iron pot, and you get that pot absolutely hot. You take your tomatoes, you take garlic, you take onion.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of doesn't matter. You know, let's say, like, if you have a gallon of tomatoes, I'd say I'd put in two onions, half a dozen cloves, good-sized cloves of garlic.
Mm-hmm.
You get the pan hot.
Yeah.
And traditionally you use pig lard to make the sauce. They're very particular about that. And it does taste delicious, even though some people just aren't going to eat it for that. But so I substitute canola or olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
And you fry the bejesus out of it. Can I say that on the radio?
You're okay.
Okay, so you hit that where it's so hot that it just almost scorches it. Not really carbonizes, doesn't turn it bitter, But I mean hot. And you have a lid close at hand.
Yeah.
Because you blend those tomatoes and all that together. I like to saute a little cinnamon stick in my oil before I go in. Because that, you know, that brings the oils. That's an oil base, too. So it's like that kind of, you know, parades through your oils. And, boy, you put that in there and you just let it go crazy. As much as you can possibly do. Now, if you try this at home, you may have to repaint the kitchen if you're not fast enough with the lid. Because it will sort of almost explode.
Yeah.
It does. So it's just like, you know, you just put it, you know, fast.
Timing is everything.
But that process, and then you just bring it down to a simmer, and then you let it cook for an hour. And it's better the next day. But this is a beautiful thing. Then you can make enchiladas with this. You can do stuffed chili rellenos. Mm. With beautiful, you know, like poblano chilies. Oh, it's making me hungry just thinking about it.
Are you growing chilies?
I am growing chilies.
Are you really?
I'm on my side beds of my tomatoes. I'm growing a number of kind of sweet European chilies that I've never grown them before. It's kind of like when you look at the seed catalog.
Yeah.
And you're like,
oh yeah.
I would
have
grown this.
So dangerous.
Well, but it's been a nice match. Yeah. I was a little worried about two nightshades in the same greenhouse like that, but. The chilies are happy as clams, man. Yeah. They are crazy.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
They love the heat, so they're both, they can deal with 120 degrees in the greenhouse.
And it's easier to do the sweet peppers, I think, than some of the hot peppers, because still the hot peppers need heat to develop that heat, and we still struggle, even in a greenhouse, you still struggle to really get the heat.
Yep.
To grow a good habanero on the North Coast is really hard.
Yeah, I haven't really even tried.
You know, it's just, it's
I'm
a challenge.
I'm doing jalapenos.
Yeah, and you can do
my
it.
My Hungarian wax are nice. And
you
spicy.
Can get a nice bite to it. Well, in this summer, it actually has turned out to be not too bad.
Yeah.
All
and
things
we have
considered.
September still.
I know. So.
Oh,
you know,
this is going to be a great, it's a
I
good
think
year.
We're okay. We're
and
okay.
You're harvesting a lot right now.
I almost pulled in right at about 300 pounds of tomatoes last week.
Wow.
I haven't
found
much of a market for the peppers. If there's anybody out there that wants sweet Hungarian, Eastern European peppers.
Ooh,
well, and
that
and
wonderful.
That leads me into how can people get a hold of your produce? Where do you sell? How
Thursday
do you,
market.
So
this beautiful new creation you guys
the
have done.
River People Farmers Market.
Yay.
Thank you.
But Thursdays, 3 to 7.
Do you also have a CSA that you were doing this year?
I do. I mean,
I know it's closed now, but you know, are you going to do that again next year for people to sign up for
I
it?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
I'm looking at expanding it and a lot of things. It's been very fascinating to kind of, you know, I've read about CSAs for many, many years.
Yeah.
But I didn't really know that they worked per se, and that whole thing of being able to get the money up front so you invest it in the garden, then you have it to grow the food with instead of having to like scrounge and, you know, get the pennies that are in your pocket lint, you know, together to get fertilizers.
Well,
to go into that with like a game plan, you know, with numbers and go, okay, I'm doing this and this.
Yeah.
That's where Ginger down
at Revolution Gardens.
Revolution Gardens. I mean, her organizational skills. Completely blow mine away.
Yeah.
But I'm learning.
You're learning. You're doing
well. And just for people that don't know what a CSA is, it stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and it's where you subscribe. You pay a farmer up front for a season of produce, and so the farmer gets the cash up front that they can then invest in their seeds and in their growing season. And then during the growing season, you get a weekly box of produce from them in you know, repayment for the investment that you made early on. So it's a really great deal for a lot of different reasons. You share in the harvest, you also share in the risks. So, you know, you're investing up front. If it's a great season, that's wonderful. And sometimes you get a real bounty of harvest. And if it's not a great season, you know, maybe you might get a lot of something or another. But it's part of like getting people involved and taking that risk along with the farmer and growing with them.
Yes.
And it's a great way to connect people to where their food comes from.
Oh, yes.
Well, and some people are doing that with restaurants, too. Restaurants are entering into a whole contract with their, as a co-producer with their farmer, helping them plan out their,
yes.
You know, their future, basically. And and I know you're selling to a lot of restaurants.
That's where, I'm still working on that relationship, you know. Mm-hmm. So much of it is tied to, like, being a more proficient farmer so I can actually project and hit my marks on production.
Yeah.
Because like right now, one of my salad beds is just not liking this heat whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's growing lettuce, but it's getting more bitter. I feel less secure about selling it. But the other one of my beds completely failed on me again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's a heat issue or what, but I had almost zero germination on it.
Yeah, it could be. It could be heat, yeah.
And
but
it
you're right,
me,
but
you know?
Restaurants want consistency.
They need consistency,
they
believe me.
And
I
you
know
that from your you chef days, yeah.
You serve a great salad one day, and then you serve a mediocre salad another. It's that's a great way to lose a customer, you know? And that's a tough one because those restaurants that are supporting me are taking those risks.
Yeah.
You know, so, but it works out well. I mean, the tomatoes have almost become a given now.
Yeah.
You know, that they're into the tomatoes. Say, Jeff at Pelicano, he writes his menu every month, you know, and he's trying to tie that next month's menu into what is coming on. Right now, green beans finally are coming on.
Isn't that exciting? Yeah.
Oh my God. And they're really tasty and worth the wait.
And what kinds are you growing?
I'm doing five different types. Two French fillets, two kind of a snap bean, and then an Italian flat.
Yeah.
You know, it's the first time I've really grown green beans.
Yeah.
But they're digging the soil.
Yeah.
And so they're tasting good. They're they'll be on the market
soon. So they'll
soon.
Be showing up at the farmer's market soon.
Yes.
Yay. And so if people want to get hold of you, are there other ways they can contact you? And I know that this will be broadcast after you're hosting the amazing Farmstock event with KMUN. If I know that you've sometimes had events at your farm or things like that. So if people, should they come to see you at the farmer's market? Do you have a website? Are there other ways to find out about
you? You know, I have a really... I have a blog that I started about a year and a half ago and have it maintained.
Mm-hmm.
So my last entry is, I don't know, last spring.
How
it's ridiculous.
How about
an
email address?
Email address. Yeah. Homegrown, HOMEGROWN at WWEST.net.
Well, Fred, thank you so much for being on with us today. And we are really looking forward to those green beans.
I know, I'm
among
super
other
excited
things,
about that.
And peppers.
Anything like that, kale. It's always fun to talk farming with you, Fred.
Talk about going back to the sugars, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we've managed to go through a half hour pretty darn fast. I think we'll have to have you back. But thank you all for joining us on today's Food Talk, fresh conversations about local food on the North Coast.
And we want to thank Mark Albrecht, our producer and engineer, and thanks to Luke and Katie for our music.
And this show will be available as a podcast at coastradio.org and can be heard this evening at 8:30 p.m. on KCPB 90.9 FM.